The Spin Rate presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. That's right, this is Spin Rate, the Athletics Toronto Blue Jays podcast. My name is Drew Fairservice, and oh boy, do we have a lot to talk about. My name is Drew, I am the host. I am joined by the co-host of Spin Rate. You read her every day, every week, every month, every hour in the Athletic itself. Her name is Caitlin McGrath. I am so excited to talk to her. Caitlin, how are you?
I'm good. One day later, well rested after a long and pretty exciting homestand.
Long and exciting homestand. Some might say, I think I saw some saying on the internet that you could probably make a not difficult case that this was the best homestand ever in Blue Jays history. They didn't win every game, or they were 9-2. They lost one to the Red Sox there on Saturday of the seven inning variety. And I guess they lost to Cleveland, one of those games they did. But in terms of vibes, in terms of performance, in terms of significance, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better homestand of all time. What Caitlin, would you say is your biggest like takeaway? What's the thing that's going to you're going to remember most? So the homestand's been 11 games, so we've already talked about the return, but that just the good vibes kept on going. I don't know, what did it feel like for you here at the end of 10 days? You needed a bit of a rest, but were the vibes as strong at the end of the week?
I think so, because obviously last week we talked about the return and all the emotions of it, but the end of the homestand had a lot of emotions too, because they were facing the Red Sox. And obviously there's a lot that goes into division rivalry. And it was the last time they were facing the Red Sox this year. They've had kind of a hard time against the Red Sox this year. All the previous times they've played the Red Sox at home has been either, I guess, in Dunedin and Buffalo, where they weren't really... they didn't really have the benefit of a home team crowd, because mostly Red Sox fans kind of flooded those sites. So it ended really strongly as well. In terms of like my takeaway, I think that like one of the takeaways is just how kind of perfect it was. Like you said, it was... You can make the case that it's one of the best homestands ever, just because of the mix of emotion of them returning, the first time that a lot of these fans are seeing guys like George Springer at their peak and Vlad at their peak, and Bo Bichette was playing really well and Marcus Semien was playing well, and their pitchers were really pitching strongly, and everything just really came together, and the crowd was excellent throughout. And the players, I think, were feeding off that as much as players can feed off that, in terms of how much benefit it actually is, probably a small percentage, but I certainly think that it had a boost. I think that there was just a lot of fun elements that came out this homestand. I wrote about it, I guess, last week, that home run jacket kind of made its debut, the last time they were in Boston, but it kind of really took hold at this homestand because the fans were actually getting to see it. And now you got people that were at the game can see in the dugout, maybe if they're sitting. So that was really fun. And I will say that like that Saturday and Sunday, those games, actually Friday, Saturday and Sunday, all three days against the Red Sox, all four games against the Red Sox, were some of the most like emotion-packed, exciting games that I've actually covered in my time covering Blue Jays. Now, keep in mind, I've only been covering them extensively since 2018. So those teams didn't really have, the 2018 team and 2019 team didn't have sort of a lot of potential, I guess, or drama around it. It was sort of that rebuilding phase for them. So more exciting, games on the line were few and far between those years. But the combination of that 9-run inning on Friday that was just like an incredible offensive display from the Blue Jays, where it was like just everyone was hitting. It was nonstop. It had the feeling of like, is this inning going to end? They did a lot of that with two outs as well. And then you had Saturday, which was two really tense, close games. The Marcus Semien, first pitch home run off Matt Barnes. It went into the left field, so it flew like right by me. You know, that was really exciting. I know it's so, having one run games are so rare for the Blue Jays, that they haven't really gone well for them. So to see a walk off, Marcus Semien's first walk off home run of his career, that was like one of the most exciting games I've seen, just because there was so much on the line. And then it topped it off with Sunday, which was like, you couldn't even script it better. I mean, I guess the Hollywood ending would have maybe been Vlad hitting that home run, but I don't know. I think it's a toss up between if George Springer hits the home run or Vlad hits the home run, what is the more perfect ending? I think either way it was fine, but that was incredible coming off Matt Barnes again. I mean, how loud it was and just the way they won in that comeback fashion. It was 2-3 of the best games that I've really seen the Blue Jays play, honestly, live in person, since I've covered them.
I think it's like the perfect storm, because they're games that are fun, games that are close, games that are emotional, but they're also games that matter, right? It's like all the elements are there, and all the elements, including winning the close game, blowing teams out. It's sort of like the things that if you're a Blue Jays fan and you're looking for like markers, like, is this for real? Did the Blue Jays do the right thing by moving, the pieces they moved to get Jose Berríos? Did they do the right thing by not trading Marcus Semien and Robbie Ray, for example, which some folks were loudly banging away that they should have done that? A lot of that stuff was put to rest. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff is like, this looks like a team that should be able to compete for a playoff spot. This looks like a team that doesn't have many foes within the American League that are better. Right. You could make a case that Houston's better. You can make a case that maybe the White Sox are better. You can't say definitively that the Red Sox are better than the Blue Jays. You can't. You'd be a fool to do so.
Yeah. Well, not the way they've been playing lately.
Not the way the Red Sox have been playing, and not the way the Blue Jays have been playing. All of that sort of, all the run differential stuff. It's not that it's all going to come home to roost all at once, but there's a lot to be excited about if you're a Blue Jays fan, watching that incredible series. And you mentioned George Springer, who for the second week in a row was named the American League Player of the Week, absolutely ascending to another plane of existence, another level of consciousness, where he's just like absolutely crushing the baseball, absolutely anchoring the lineup from the top. Unbelievable.
The home run that he hit on Sunday was absolutely a no-doubter right off the bat. Like, I was there and obviously saw it going into left center field. But then when I, and so it looked like it was going out the whole way, so I could tell, but I don't hear it off the bat in the press box. Mm. So when I watched the video back, just hearing how he connected and then looking at the pitch location, I don't know what Matt Barnes was doing there. I mean, obviously he missed his spot, but like just off the bat, it was just an incredible home run. I think it actually was his second furthest home run this season. I'm guessing the furthest one is still that one that might have been his first or second home run as a Blue Jay, where he really hit it out of the park.
Landed it on the school.
In Dunedin.
In that little cameo, the little George Springer spoiler alert. It's funny you talk about that pitch, because I was thinking about the same thing. And if you watch, what's his name, Pilecki or whatever the catcher's name is for Boston, he sort of sets up down and away, like he wants the ball kind of down and away, and then he moves the target sort of high in the strike zone, just as Barnes is going to kind of going into his motion. So it's like, okay, what's the real target here? Was it down and away? Did he want it to go back? Did he want it to go up? But it is just an absolute beat, like cookie, like right down the middle. 90. I mean, it's 95, but right into his bat path, a little bit of that like leaking right in onto the barrel, and he did not miss. And he's been incredible. And because he's a good player, it's not really a complicated thing. He's not some babe in the woods who's like, I'm wandering out and is just by chance performing at a high level. He's a really good player who's playing really well. He's not this good. Just us, just between friends. I don't think George Springer is going to continue to hit as he has for the last 2 weeks. But he also has like a nearly 1,000 OPS for the season, which is, I mean, maybe he's probably not that good, but he's still really good and he's playing really well. And it's just the Blue Jays are capable of scoring a lot of runs. But I think the biggest story, so Blue Jays scored a lot of runs. Marcus Semien hit that key. Obviously, Matt Barnes again threw one pitch in Saturday's opener and then was able to pitch in the nightcap, getting the save for Boston. But he threw one pitch. Semien hit it into left center field. It was a home run. Not quite as far as George Springer's, but offense, you know, that was some timely offense, although they didn't score a ton of runs there on Saturday. Scored a bunch on Friday, scored 9 on Sunday. So offense is doing what we kind of come to expect it to, even with like slightly less than what we've come to expect in terms of performance from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But I think the thing we should talk about is the pitching. And, anyone who watched the Blue Jays in April or even May didn't think they were capable of winning too many 1-0 games. But now, I don't know, Caitlin, what do you make of the way that the team has pitched both in the rotation and in the bullpen?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really good. I was looking a little bit at the numbers yesterday of the rotation. And I have to say, like, the rotation has been, I think, steady since end of May, June. Like, it, to me, it hasn't been a huge problem in terms of that's the reason why they weren't doing well. There was a lot of collective things. Obviously, the bullpen was the bigger issue in May and June. But looking at the numbers, I can't remember off the top of my head, but the Blue Jays, I do remember, like, since the All-Star break, their pitchers have, like, I think the fourth lowest ERA since that All-Star break, which obviously includes the two starts from Berríos, who is an essential add. He's looked great in his two starts for the Blue Jays, pretty much almost perfect, right? He's only allowed one earned run. It was on this home run from Alex Verdugo that was kind of a wall scraper in center field, which helped Boston win that game. But he's been excellent. Robbie Ray has been great. And the numbers that the starters put up in that homestand before Ryu's kind of dud there on Sunday, I think their collective ERA for that 10 games was like 1.34. Like, it was incredible. Like, the starters were really great. And, you know, obviously they were facing teams. The Royals aren't a great offensive team. The Cleveland is a terrible offensive team.
The worst. So, God, yeah. They're awful.
So, you know, the competition wasn't stiff, but, you know, still major league teams, obviously. And they pitched well against Boston for
another terrible offensive team
for three of those games. And, Ryu was not himself. I don't necessarily think it's anything to panic about because we've seen him waver a little bit this year and then he's usually kind of bounced back. So I wouldn't be too worried about him. I think that the rotation is in a really good spot right now. And, they're actually coming upon a decision soon where they're going to have to cut it back down to 5 starters. They've been going with 6 guys in the rotation because they've had these double headers and they've had a really busy schedule, something like, I don't know, 25 games in 24 days or something like that. And so they've been using 6 guys. And so there's going to be, I guess, kind of a little head-on-head competition, I guess, on Tuesday between Matz and Stripling because they're each starting one of those double header games. They both are coming. I mean, Matz has been pretty good since the All-Star break. Ross Stripling has been like, you know, if you take out the numbers, someone tweeted this and I saw it. If you take out the numbers against Boston, where he's just been awful this year. But outside of starts against Boston, he's been, you know, an above average starter. I don't know if it's necessarily sustainable or if this is like, you know, Ross Stripling's career year or whatever, although I think he was an All-Star one year in with the Dodgers. And I don't know what his numbers were that year, but yeah, like overall, starting pitching has been great. It's better now with Berríos. Obviously, the bullpen has been holding its own. I still don't think it's a perfect group, but guys have been pitching better. Losing Tim Mesa for an injury is not ideal, but I'm willing.
Very not ideal.
I don't get the sense that it's serious. I got the sense more that he was feeling some pain in the elbow, and this seemed like a good opportunity to just give him some rest to make sure that he can finish strong. And, you know, they had these double headers and they have an off day. And so you think with the double headers, you can get away with fewer relievers because you hope that your starters can give you 6. And, I mean, they did that both on the Saturday doubleheader. True. And so against the Angels, I guess, I don't know if you're going to get six out of Steven Matz or Ross Stripling, but you would hope that you get five, and then you're really just covering four innings there.
From even if you only get four, right? Even if you only get four innings out of a
guy
like
Matz. It's just
not
as much to cover, yeah.
No, and the Angels are not a great offensive team, especially given, you know, some of the injuries that they've experienced. We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
There's a really interesting article that Mike Petriello, who's been a guest on this show, writes for StatCast and whatever. He wrote a lot about how the Blue Jays pitching has really become elite and how they've become one of the best starting pitchers since teams starting staff since the beginning of July. How since June they've had a really, really good since June 19th they've got 27-15 record. Like, the Jays are really good. But one of the key takeaways from his story, which is, I think is reflective of the way that they've kind of built the team, is that the Blue Jays have basically pitched almost zero high leverage innings over the last few months because they've kind of got a great setup because they've got some strong starting pitching that, you know, with Matz and Stripling offering some good starts is like a huge boon, but with Ryu pitching well, you know, has had some ups and downs this year. Manoah has been so strong and such a boon to the rotation. And then now Jose Berríos, that a big offense and strong to competent to, you know, successful starting pitching means they're not playing a lot of close games, right? If the starters are able to go in and not have blow up starts and do what they've done, you know, again, even, you know, if it's Ross Stripling, Steve Matz, if they don't have to go out there and throw eight shutout innings and strike out 14, if they have a decent start, the offense, you know, is going to score runs. And then, so you're not asking so much of the bullpen. So the ability to sort of like shuffle the deck in a way, and on top of the lack of hot, quote unquote, high leverage innings, but you've got amazing performance from Richards. You've got amazing performance from Simber. You know, Tim Mazza has been great. So you're able to like weather the Brad Hand sort of feeling his way around, or you're able to initially put Ryan Barucki into less leverage situations. Then, you know, we haven't really talked about Ryan Barucki sent down to AAA. Yeah. I mean, maybe surprise isn't the right word, but he's not a guy that you would have assumed at any point was going to get sent down. But I don't think it's the wrong thing to do. He was getting, we talked about this, I believe you and I last time, he was getting destroyed and he had nothing to get right-handers out, gave up a big home run. I can't remember. He's given up a few, but you know, they've just set themselves up where they didn't need to make a huge, you know, they didn't need to go and get Craig Kimbrell, because the way that the team has performed and has been built, they're kind of okay the way they are. I don't know. Maybe that's not something you want to bank on long term or into if you're playing in October, but it's hard to argue with the way that they've played and the way that this sort of has all shaken out as the team has really kind of gelled or molded. I'm trying to think of like a good sports cliche. They've really gelled. They're really gelling at the right time, really firing on all cylinders. I don't know. They got good players and now they've augmented those good players with other kinds of good players. And it looks pretty good so far.
Yeah, I would agree. Obviously Ryan Barucki going down is disappointing for him, but I think that it also is just them suggesting that he needs to go work on some stuff. And I don't think by any means they're you know, giving up on Ryan Barucki. I think them sending them down is just to say, we want you to figure it out and we want to take some pressure off so that you can figure it out. And maybe he can be a factor down the stretch run. And yeah, you mentioned Simber and Richards. I mean, I think that Berríos was an excellent add at the deadline and he's the, you know, he's the signature addition, but getting Richards and Simber when they got them a little bit ahead of the deadline for just really affordable costs there. Those to me are, you know, the bigger deals, the most impactful deals, just because of how quickly they help turn around things in the bullpen. Rafael Dolis, we have not mentioned him at all lately, but he's really finding it again. And he tends to be somewhat of a, I don't know, confounding type of player. He kind of can, he can go.
That's very kind of you.
he sometimes takes the sort of a long winding path towards outs as opposed to sort of the, you know, the shortcuts, but he's had 9 straight scoreless innings and, you know, that's pretty good. And so he looks like, and that's sometimes you have to hope if you're a team and if you're Ross Atkins, you just have to sometimes hope that the relievers that you get who tend to be up and down guys just go on a nice run at a good time. Like, you know, if Dolis was going to struggle this year, maybe it was better that he was struggling in May and June when everyone in the bullpen was struggling. And that he's turning around now is, you know, it could just be fortunate luck for the Blue Jays in the sense that, like, okay, he's worked his way through the injuries and, you know, maybe he's going to give you this 2-month stretch where he's really good and he's figured it out again, because he was effective last year. We've seen him be effective. He can get guys to, you know, swing over his pitches and he generates a lot of soft contact. And Brad Hand's the same way too. And that, like, if the Blue Jays know he's had an up and down year, if they can just get him on a hot streak for 6 weeks or something, you know, that's maybe just what they hope to get out of that trade. I also saw, I think Riley Adams had a nice game there. I think he hit a home run for Washington. So good for Riley Adams. But
good for Rowdy Tellez, who's of course killing.
Yes,
it, right?
He's excellent. And like I think we said this before, but that was a trade that it really looks like it benefited both teams, at least for now. I mean, the Blue Jays got what they needed in Trevor Richards. He's been excellent. And the Brewers look like they got what they needed in Rowdy Tellez. And so that worked out for both of them. But yeah, the bullpen definitely, you know, I think it's not a perfect group.
No.
But the way that the Blue Jays are built, like you said, and like Mike's article said, is that, you know, that they can succeed with this formula that they've put together. And that is having a respectable bullpen, having a strong starting staff where you're getting some career years out of some guys, and then just having an elite offense.
There were some questions about the bullpen management on Sunday, which again, it all comes out in the wash because the Blue Jays won. But Patrick Murphy inherited 3 runners, allowed them all to score. You know, he got 4 outs, gave up 3 hits, you know, not ideal. Kirby Snead came in and gave up a run, you know, kind of just not super, super effective, allowed 3 base runners in an inning and 2/3. And then Dolis kind of came in a lower leverage spot, and he's been good and he pitched well. He threw himself an inning and a third, but like you can't complain because they won, and somebody's got to come in. If Ryu is getting the hook in the fourth inning, like somebody's got to come in and pitch the fourth inning. So if the suggestion is you're using Simber or you're using Richards in the fourth inning, it seems like a bit of a tough sell. So if those are your low leverage guys, you're doing fine, right? If Patrick Murphy is getting a bit of some run as a low leverage guy and it doesn't work out, there's somebody else who's waiting to come right up and take that place. You know, they do have some depth of guys who have gotten outs for them at the big league level, you know, not every time out, but they're in a good spot. You really, 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 really can't complain. Now, one thing you can't complain about if you're an old person is that the Blue Jays are going out west. They are going to the West Coast, as you alluded or referred to. They will be playing 4 games against the Anaheim Angels, including a doubleheader coming up on Tuesday with Steven Matz and the other guy, Ross Stripling pitching. Anaheim on the fringes of being able to tell themselves that they're still in the wild card race, which, you know, you love to see it. You love to see teams deluding themselves into believing. But, I mean, Anaheim is one game over 500. I believe they have a negative run differential. They traded one of their starters there in the middle of the at the trade deadline, and Andrew Heaney, who went to the Yankees, which is you never love to see. But, look, the Angels have a lot of talent. Obviously, it's concentrated in one particular roster spot. But these the games against Cleveland, like the games against Kansas City, these are games that the Blue Jays have to feel as though they need to win as many of them as they possibly can. What do you think about going in and facing the Angels in Anaheim?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I do wonder how the Blue Jays will kind of respond to going back on the road. And then obviously on the West Coast, it's tough to sort of adjust your, I don't know, body clock to playing those games because it feels much later for you. You know, I think the Blue Jays, I don't know their record, but I feel like have they played well in those double headers? I think the seven innings tends to help a lot of teams, but the Blue Jays in particular tends to help them because of all the things we just talked about the fact that, you know, they can get five or six innings out of their starter, and then if they hit, they can really kind of coast to the end there. And that's a good formula for them to cover less innings. I agree that those are games that they should win. This will be a good test for the Blue Jays because they have so much momentum going that one of the sort of frustrating elements of this Blue Jays team has been some of their uneven play. And so they play so well and they have these sort of emotional wins against Boston. And we've seen them have these big wins before. And you think, okay, here's the team going on a run. This is where the run's going to start. And then they kind of have a deflating loss or they kind of lose a few. Like the Mets series to me sticks out as like it looked like a really winnable series, especially they had that big game one of the days and then they ended up losing two close ones. And so that was a while ago now. They've kind of had this positive momentum. Maybe they're feeling a lot better about themselves, believing a little more. And so they go into Anaheim. I don't think Anaheim's a particularly tough place to play. Like you said, the team's not really in it. They don't have one of their best players playing for them yet.
They don't have three of their best players. Anthony yes. Rendon is out for the year. I don't want to talk too much about the Angels. We're going to talk about them on tomorrow's podcast. But
okay.
Rendon is out for the year. Yes. Obviously, a very good player. Has not performed at a very high level for them. Jared Walsh, who was an all-star this year, is also injured. And, of course, Mike Trout is injured and not playing. But the one game, of course, the Blue Jays will need to keep their eye on is Wednesday's game when Alek Manoah will go to the hill against Shohei Ohtani.
Is it Wednesday or Thursday?
I thought it was Wednesday. Am I speaking out of turn? I'll be mad if I'm wrong, but I probably am. I thought I read Wednesday, but either way, I'm pretty sure it's Ohtani against Manoah. Which is that'll be a fun matchup. Like, I don't know if you've heard this or not. Shohei Ohtani is pretty good.
Is he?
He has changed also as the season has progressed. No, you're right. It is Thursday. Oh, Thursday yes. the 11th.
So then who's he going up? Then he's not going up against Manoah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, what the hell? I'm mad now.
No, he's going up against Berríos.
Oh, he is on the 12th. Yeah.
That's still a good matchup.
It's an even better matchup. It's like a bit of a Spider-Man versus pointing at Spider-Man matchup. But nonetheless, Shohei Ohtani is really, really, really good. He's not as much of the strikeout guy as he was earlier in the year, which I have said multiple times owes to the sticky stuff crackdown. His splitter is not quite as reliable as it had been, but he's pitched so well recently against bad offenses too. But again, that just like the games against the Blue Jays, they all count. They're all big league teams. Mm-hmm. You're playing big league hitters. Jose Ramirez plays for Cleveland, so we can talk about them being dog shit all we want. He's still really good, and you still got to get him out 3, 4, 5 times in a night. So beyond the Angels, there's another interesting series against Seattle, who mm-hmm. are a bit of like the Blue Jays expansion cousins. this will have a little bit of a different look for a few reasons. They're like the Blue Jays expansion cousins, but like the hideous kind of like living under a bridge cousins. Seattle does not have any kind of a track record of success. They have made the playoffs since 2001, I believe. And on top of all of that, they were having a bit of a charmed season this year. Mm-hmm. You know, the opposite story of the Blue Jays, winning every one-run game, not scoring, you know, giving up more runs than they score, but still having a strong record, still being right there in the wild card race. And their general manager traded their closer. And then it all went to shit, which is not, they haven't lost a bunch of games of late because I traded Kendall Graveman, but it sure looks like it. And it's a delightful moment for just the six org magic to really work. You're too young to know the six org thing, but what do you think about going in and playing Seattle? Seattle played the Blue Jays really tough in wherever it was, Buffalo. Think. But again, maybe not the most talented team in the world, but obviously a team that's got doing a few things right this year. Those are going to be tough games without, apparently, according to you, because you know the big home support, the big BC based support the Blue Jays often enjoy in Seattle.
Yeah, I probably should have double checked this before coming on.
Yeah, but I had a bullet point about it being because people are crossing, people are coming in, but I don't think the border's open both ways. Is it? Is it true?
I think that it's just open one way. I think Americans are eligible to come in, vaccinated Americans are able to come in, but I don't think the U.S. border is open yet for Canadians. I think that's in a couple weeks. I don't know why it's different, but I don't know. Maybe I'll just keep talking if you're looking it up. But
I am.
Okay. The Seattle series will be really interesting because you're right that the Seattle played them tough. And I'm trying to think back on that series, and I think that that was one of those frustrating series where it seemed really winnable for the Blue Jays. I don't know if there was a bullpen blow up in that series. I should have looked back and remembered. But Seattle's had that charm season. They kind of were brought back down to earth by the Yankees this past weekend. I think it was a 4-game series, and they lost it 3-1 against the Yankees, which we haven't really mentioned the Yankees, but also someone tweeted this today. I think it was a Red Sox reporter that the three of the best teams coming out of the All-Star break have been the Rays, the Yankees, and the Blue Jays. And one of the worst teams coming out of the All-Star break has been the Red Sox. And so pairing the Red Sox sort of struggles with everyone around them coming in after the break and just playing some of their best baseball has made the AL East really, really interesting. I think prior to the Blue Jays playing the Red Sox, I think on July 30th, I looked it up and the Blue Jays were 8.5 games back of the Boston Red Sox, who at that point were still in first in the East. And by the end of the series, the Blue Jays were 3 games back of the Boston Red Sox, who had fallen to second and were then, I think they were tied or are tied currently with Oakland for the wild cards. I think they have the same record or they're both holding those two spots. And the Yankees are like 2.5 games back and the Blue Jays are 3 games back of the wild card. So there can be a lot of shifting, and the Blue Jays have an opportunity here to control their own fate. I wrote about that a couple times recently, but even a week ago, the Seattle series looked even bigger because Seattle was actually ahead of the Blue Jays. Now it still is a big series. They still should win those games if they want to kind of keep pace with the rest of the division and with the wild card race. But Blue Jays have a lot of opportunities to just kind of control their season from here on out. Like they don't have to, they have to sort of hope maybe the Red Sox keep losing and maybe the A's lose a couple games and make things a little easier so they can actually move up as opposed to just keeping pace. But they have a lot of series, they have a lot of games against the Orioles, which they can rack up some wins. They have series still against Detroit, I think 6 games. They've got 7 games against the Twins. They've got games against the Yankees where they can control their fate. They've got games against Seattle. Like there's a pretty good schedule for the Blue Jays in terms of just like, you know, quote unquote, easy opponents or winnable games, but also just games where like you are facing the team that you are chasing and this is your opportunity to close the gap. So have you looked up the Canadian border laws?
I'm not getting a straight answer in a way that's satisfying to me right now. Okay. But well, it doesn't
to me,
look
that
like
suggests,
it.
Exactly. I think that it's not clear. And to me that suggests, I think it's more September when there's going to be more travel, but anyway.
More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors. The one thing I was thinking about the opportunity to play against a team like Seattle and the equivalent and Anaheim to a much lesser extent is you have the chance to even just clear out some traffic. because the worst part about the wild card is, oh, well, we're only this many games behind, but there's four teams that could be ahead of us, that sort of thing, if you're thinking from a team perspective. So if the Blue Jays are able to kind of like put their foot on the neck of the Angels, effectively end their season. Same with Seattle. Seattle is, I think, two and a half games back of the Blue Jays right now in the wild card standings. The Blue Jays can start to just pound on those losses, add a few losses to that Mariners ledger. It will really make it difficult for Seattle to then not only leapfrog and just kind of be in the mix more than they have to. And then that way the Blue Jays can focus on, as you just laid out, some of the opportunities ahead of them. A, against bad teams, B, against teams that are in that mix with them as well. Because that's really where that opportunity lies. I also think that I don't believe that they should rule out the division. Right, I think that, you know, it might be a pipe dream, and it might be
not that
they're ever going to do that. Not that the Blue Jays are like, you know what, no, we've given up on the division. but again, they are in fourth place. They are seven games back of Tampa. But you know, even the games back is a little bit deceiving, as we've discussed. The Blue Jays are only one game behind Tampa or Boston in the loss column. So you know, that's the mentality that the players always bring into this, is like, you can't make up losses, but you can make up wins. So they've played fewer games than Boston, for example. So All they got to do is win games, and then they're tied. They don't have to worry about Boston losing. They just got to win, and they'll be good. So it's a big week. They're all going to be big weeks from here on out. And yeah, I don't know. It's exciting, and it's a bummer that they won't have that sort of Seattle putting that shoe back on the other foot a little bit in terms of being able to be the nuisance fans that the locals hate.
You know, but, what though? Sorry to interrupt you, but I feel like I was actually thinking about this today, and I have a renewed perspective on that. In that I have talked to the Blue Jays players now who have experienced being a home team and having the entire crowd against you at your quote unquote home. Now, it was different because their home was not their actual home ballpark. It was Buffalo and it was Dunedin. But to hear the Blue Jays talk about how tough it was when the Yankees fans were in Buffalo and getting on them and booing them, and you know how much that kind of sucked to have a home series where you don't feel like you're the home team. And so I feel like I always came at the Seattle perspective of like, how cool is it that the Blue Jays fans in BC get to go? And I still think that's nice. I don't want to sound like I don't want them to be there and get to cheer the Blue Jays, because they only get that once a year, and now they're probably not going to get it for another year. So that's going to be 2 years for them, I guess, not getting to see their team. So I totally understand why they go there. I'm just saying that I kind of feel for the Mariners a little bit more now, just kind of understanding how that can, you know, bother players, or how that can be really distracting, or feel like, feel like a real disadvantage when your home ballpark is not your home ballpark for a series. And so, you know, I've always heard it from the Blue Jays perspective where it's so great for those players. And I still think it is. And it's great for the fans. It's great for everyone in Western Canada who gets to see the Blue Jays, like I said. But I just feel like I have a renewed perspective from the Seattle Mariners' point of view, just talking to the Blue Jays and what they've gone through for the last year. So yeah, I was actually thinking about that today, and I was like, you know, I kind of understand now why the Mariners don't love it. Now, look, the Mariners are still making a lot of money because the Blue Jays bring in a lot of people from BC to see those games. And I don't know that Blue Jays series would sell out necessarily in Seattle, although I do think that ballpark does pretty well. I don't know what they draw in attendance, but it's a nice ballpark. So maybe people just like going there. I just mean the team hasn't been very good for years, but
I feel like
they benefit from it. But I just, yeah, that's my point of view from it now. It's like, I kind of feel bad for the Seattle Mariners fans when they have to go through that.
I feel bad for Seattle Mariners fans.
And players.
You know, and players. There's a guy that I follow for a long time on Twitter, who is like he worked for the Mariners for like 4 years. And even when he was a fan, he was like, just, they hate it. They hate that weekend. Yeah. Everybody hates it. Especially because we can all be honest. So like the fans who come down from BC, it's like a party, and they do not exactly behave in a way that is – that is reflective of, like, if you went to a Blue Jays game, like, it is a heightened experience. Those people are sauced up and just like having determined to have the time of their lives. So it is something that's missing. And I will say that the American border will not be open to non-essential Canadian travel until August 21st.
There you go.
So they will not, unless those games are after that, which they aren't.
They're not. They're just missing it by a week or so.
Yeah. But vaccinated Americans are free to come with the test as well. Free to come to Canada. Lots of folks going to visit their cottages for the first time in 2 years, as I've seen and experienced as well. Anything else, Caitlin, that's on your mind? I was going to throw it open to you. We did talk about Ben Wagner back on the call. Speaking of cottages, I think a lot of people associate cottage with baseball on the radio. It's great whenever you can do it, whenever you can hear it. It's just like night and day, a delightful moment of night and day. We did talk about this last time as well. What else do you have coming up for us this week? Are you ready to burn the midnight oil after this, being back in your own seat? Suddenly you're back, thrown back onto your couch and now having to stay up late and watch West Coast games?
Yeah, I'm not crazy about the West Coast time difference. It's tough. It's late. I think that the Angels games are half an hour earlier, which is nice. The Seattle games are later starts. But yeah, I'll have a few things coming. I haven't actually made my editorial plan for this week because I took today off from writing. So I have to. But I think I'm planning something fun with our Angels writer. We're going to combine and do something fun. Maybe you guys can guess what that might be, but I'll just tease it that me and our relatively new Angels writer, Sam, are joining up to work on a piece together. So that should come out probably like Wednesday or Thursday, I think.
That's exciting. Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. And if you want to read that and you want to read everything that Caitlin writes, I, of course, will encourage you to subscribe to The Athletic. If you do not already, you should go to theathletic.com/spinrate. You'll get a tidy discount and you'll let them know that we sent you, which keeps us going, keeps us cranking out the shows, which is a lot of fun. I don't know what your story. I have a guess. Maybe it could be anything. There's obviously the Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Vladimir Guerrero Sr. thing. But there's also, of course, the Ohtani thing that anyone can always look to talk about. But enough about all of that. If you ever wanted to look for a story about what would happen if Ohtani the pitcher faced Ohtani the hitter, I wrote that story in 2018. You can Google. It's on Vice, vice.com.
Does it still hold up? Like, or is he different enough of a pitcher now or different enough of a hitter now that it doesn't quite hold up?
You know, the part that holds up the best is that the hitter that I comped him to was Matt Olson, who is also having a career year at the same time as Ohtani. I think that, you know, seeing what I've seen from Ohtani this year, I think that Ohtani the pitcher is wild enough outside of the strike zone that he could probably keep his fastball away from Ohtani the hitter. And he throws enough junk that he might be able to get Ohtani the batter to get himself out, because he does do that. If his changeup was working, his splitter was like really working, I think Ohtani the pitcher would destroy Ohtani the hitter, unless he walked him. And then if he walked him, then Ohtani the hitter would steal like second and third on probably the same pitch, going all the way around. But we didn't talk about that. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. stole a base yesterday on Sunday off of Adam Ottavino, his old rival. One last thing that I will say that I saw somewhere all these things come together. Adam Ottavino, of course, who came in on Sunday and actually pitched pretty well. I guess he was responsible for a couple of the runners that then Matt Barnes. Am I remembering that correctly?
No, he came in the seventh and then they were aggressive. And then Teoscar got thrown out between second and third. And then Corey Dickerson got thrown off at second. So So Adam Ottavino, was fine. He allowed a few hits, but then the Blue Jays kind of got themselves out of that inning. So
the thing about Adam Ottavino is he's a clown, because he was, I'm going to find the tweet here. It's from a couple earlier. On Shohei Ohtani's birthday, Adam Ottavino got him out and then said, "Happy birthday, bitch," to Shohei Ohtani. At that time, the Red Sox were 54-32 and led the AL East by 4.5 games. Since then, They have gone, I believe this is now out of date. They've gone, I think 10 or they've gone 11 and 17 and are now four games back or however many games back. So Adam Ottavino cursed the Red Sox season by cursing Shohei Ohtani. That's it. That's all I've got. That's all we've got. So again, if you want to subscribe to The Athletic, you can do that at the website. If you want to subscribe to the show, you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. If it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify. I've seen some people talking about they're moving on from Apple Podcasts. I don't know if you're ready to do that, but you can subscribe wherever you go. Overcast, Stitcher, all those places. SpinRate is there and ready for you. And if you're listening to this on Tuesday, get ready. There's going to be another episode tomorrow recording an Angels-centric Blue Jays podcast. Talking about the Blue Jays, talking about the Angels. Tomorrow with a good friend of mine. Can talk about the Angels and talk about the Blue Jays and so much more. Her name is Caitlin McGrath. My name is Drew Fairservice. We will talk to you next time on SpinRate.